Now, shall we begin?
Based upon our thorough and exhaustive review of the facts of this case, it is my conclusion that the use of deadly force by Officer Yanez was not justified, and that sufficient facts exist to prove this to be true. Accordingly, we filed a criminal complaint this morning in Ramsey County District Court charging Officer Yanez with second-degree manslaughter in the death of Philando Castile and two felony counts of dangerous discharge of a firearm that endangered the safety of Diamond Reynolds and her four-year-old daughter, the two passengers in the car.
Minnesota resident Philando Castile was murdered, no other word is satisfactory, by an armed stranger who went just a little bit too far in the exercise of powers that no human being can legitimately possess, according to the assessment of the local prosecutor who investigated this killing. Castile had been stopped on scores of occasions by local law enforcement in what could be reasonably considered a pattern of particularized harassment. During the fatal encounter with Officer Geronimo Yanez, Castile behaved exactly as he had been taught by law enforcement. He was submissive, not merely respectful, but submissive. He clearly and unambiguously informed Yanez that he had a license to carry a handgun, and he was in the process of producing his driver's license and his handgun license when he was shot by the panicking Officer Yanez in front of Castile's girlfriend and her four-year-old daughter. He has been charged, Officer Yanez, with manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, an offense that carries a prison term of no longer than 10 years. The most infuriating aspect of what is the exercise of residual blue privilege, even after a prosecutor has decided, contrary to the burden of expectations, that he's going to be prosecuting an officer who is involved in the unlawful killing of an innocent human being, is that Yanez was not even taken into custody. There are people who are taken into custody for failing to return a library book in that jurisdiction, killing an innocent human being, assuming, of course, that the killer is clothed in qualified immunity, is to that extent not considered as serious an offense as failing to return a library book. And I contend that is because a police officer is seen as exercising a proprietary function in the taking of a human life. He's acting on behalf of the government that presumably owns us and can bulk to us incrementally through taxation and through revenue-focused issuance of citations, and then, whenever it is considered to be appropriate, can impose the 100% tax of the taking of a human life, even in circumstances in which this doesn't involve the defense of another human being against aggression by a criminal suspect. That was the mindset that Yanez brought to this encounter. He had been indoctrinated through a bulletproof warrior officer survival course that was designed to impart to its students what one police trainer called a paranoid and militaristic mindset. I previously described some elements of this training program. In May of 2014, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Yanez underwent a 20-hour seminar on street survival that was taught by Caliber Press, which is based in Illinois. This company offers this indoctrination to police officers nationwide. Their street survival seminar overview displays what I consider to be a monomaniacal focus on that most important of all imaginable policy considerations, officer safety, treating every police encounter as a combat situation in which only one life truly matters, and that is of the government's armed emissary rather than that of the citizen who is supposedly being protected and served by the officer. Caliber co-owner Jim Glennon has written that viewing police as the enemy is not a healthy or helpful position for a society to take. However, the courses presented by his company relentlessly immerse officers in the idea that the public is their enemy. One instructor in a Caliber Press presentation of the sort that Geronimo Yanez had undergone summarized the course for the benefit of his students by saying, we've got to survive this job. This job, once again, is not the protection of persons and property. It is the collection of revenue on behalf of the state. It is state-licensed predation against persons and property. And that is a dangerous job. And in that capacity, police officers, to be brutally frank about it, are entitled to no sympathy at all whatsoever. The goal and purpose of the Caliber Press Street Survival Seminar is twofold: keep officers alive and give them the tools to enjoy a successful career in law enforcement, explains the promotional literature produced by the company. In order to accomplish this mission, we need to tackle the realities and complexities of policing today for officers on the street while placing the responsibility for winning right where it belongs, with the individual officer. Winning in what context? Well, prevailing in the encounter between a member of the productive class and a privileged enforcer representing the interests of the parasitical class. A brief video excerpt from a street survival course that had been taken down from the website of Caliber Press after I publicized this several months ago shows a presenter lecturing officers about the need to visualize shooting someone as part of the psychological game necessary to win encounters with what trainees are told is an implacably hostile public. And once again, that hostility is entirely justified. When somebody is detained or seized, that's the legal term of art, by a police officer, from that point on, the victim of this seizure is regarded as the property of the police officer until the police officer decides to let you go. That's a function very similar to that of slave overseers during the antebellum period of American history, which I think is one of the reasons why you see so often negative encounters between police officers and Americans of African ancestry who, for cultural and historical reasons, don't like to be treated as if they were somebody else's property. And that's an attitude I wish would become contagious on the part of Americans of all backgrounds. Traffic stops kill police officers, injure police officers. That's a fact, insists a Caliber Press lecturer. But, and I'll say this, it's our bread and butter for enforcement. That is to say, it is the central function that they carry out, is extracting revenue through citations. Not the protection of persons and property, not solving crimes against persons and property, but the extraction of revenue through the threat of lethal force is the bread and butter of law enforcement. It is because the public understandably and justifiably resents being on the receiving end of that type of attention that they, that is to say the police, face potential hazards in the course of the job that they have chosen. Local police had certainly feasted on Philando Castile. He had been stopped 52 times over the course of 14 years and paid thousands of dollars in citations. He had no criminal record beyond traffic misdemeanors. He was known to the St. Anthony Police Department, which patrolled the town where the fatal traffic stop occurred. Yanez claimed to have believed that Castile broadly resembled a suspect in a recent armed robbery, and that might explain why he made a pretext stop, but it does not explain, nor does it justify, why he opened fire on a citizen who was compliant and who possessed a valid carry permit. And that's an interesting part of the story that has received scandalously scant attention from the gun lobby. Here's a case of somebody who had a valid carry permit in a state that's not terribly hospitable to armed self-defense and to the personal ownership of firearms. When he was stopped by a police officer, the citizen was respectful and submissive, displayed precisely that cluster of attitudes that citizens are supposedly required to exhibit, and yet he was shot for no reason by a police officer, and we've heard nothing from the NRA or Gun Owners of America about this outrage. Prior to the indictment being issued against Officer Yanez for the killing of Philando Castile, the officer's police union attorney had claimed that the mere presence of a gun in the possession of a mundane was adequate to trigger the officer's lethal reaction. That makes sense in terms of what Yanez had been taught by the Caliber Press indoctrination, but it doesn't make sense from the perspective of the law. The force used has to be reasonable and necessary, street survival attendees such as Yanez were told. And who judges if it's reasonable and necessary? It is to the officer's standards. Does the public understand and are they trained in the dynamics of the use of force as you and I are? No, continued that harangue. And this, presumably, is why police must act as evangelists to the ignorant public, catechizing the rest of us about the sacred imperative of officer safety and the purported duty of citizens to submit with docility in every encounter we have with the state's agents of coercion. Teach them, the lecturer exhorted. Establish, articulate, and indoctrinate. And if you experience so much as a tremor of anxiety, annihilate the person who is responsible for it, acting in the serene confidence that even if you are prosecuted, you're not going to be prosecuted for murder, because implicitly the person on the receiving end of your privileged violence is not fully human, but to some extent the property of the state. And I will have a great deal more to say about this in just a few minutes. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
Stops, kill police officers, injure police officers. That's a fact. But I'm going to say this, it's our bread and butter for enforcement. We have to look at every single traffic stop as to how we did it and could we have done better, thinking tactically.
With deep sorrow, we have perused the statement of the case as it appeared upon the evidence, wrote Chief Justice Thomas Ruffin of the North Carolina Supreme Court. In the case of State versus Hoover in 1839, and we cannot surmise a ground on which the prisoner could expect a venire de novo, that is to say, a new trial. Indeed, it seems to us that the case was left hypothetically to the jury much more favorably for the prisoner than the circumstances authorized. A master may lawfully punish his slave, and the degree must, in general, be left to his own judgment and humanity. That is a claim, I contend, that is morally cognate with the concept of qualified immunity in the exercise of punitive violence or lethal force by a police officer. They are given full discretion with respect to the degree to which they will exercise coercion upon somebody claimed as the property of others. In the case of chattel slavery, the individual on the receiving end of this violence was considered the property of the individual identified as the slave owner. In the case of a citizen being stopped by a police officer, the citizen is considered to be, to some extent, the property of this murderous abstraction called the state, which is made tangible in the person of the police officer. A master may lawfully punish his slave, and the degree must, in general, be left to his own judgment and humanity, and cannot be judicially questioned. That is called qualified immunity, as it applied to chattel slave quote-unquote owners in the antebellum South. However, there are circumstances in which the exercise of that supposed authority shocks the conscience. The master's authority is not altogether unlimited, continued Chief Justice Ruffin. He must not kill. There is, at least, this restriction upon his power. He must stop short of taking life. It has been repeatedly held that, independent of the Act of 1791, the killing of a slave may, note the qualifier, amount to murder, and this rule includes a killing by the master as well as that by a stranger. It must indeed be true in the nature of things that a killing by the owner may be extenuated by many circumstances from which no palliation could be derived in favor of a stranger. You can't do that to my slave, only I can do that to my slave, is the implicit message of that specimen of tortured legalese. But it is almost self-evident that this prisoner, that is to say, Mr. Hoover, the one who had been convicted of murdering a slave by the name of Mira, can claim no extenuation of his guilt before the highest grade. It is perhaps sufficient merely to declare that to be the opinion of the court, without undertaking the revolting task of collating and minutely commenting on the horrid enormities detailed by the witnesses. In a statement of the facts of the case, we can find the following. The prisoner was put on trial at Iredell on the last circuit before His Honor Judge Dick for the murder of his own female slave, a woman named Mira. The witnesses called on the part of the state testified to a series of the most brutal and barbarous whippings, scourgings, and privations inflicted by the prisoner on the deceased from about the 1st of December to the time of her death in the ensuing March, while she was in the latter stages of pregnancy, and afterwards, during the period of her confinement and recovery from a recent delivery. A physician who was one of the coroner's inquest, called to view the body of the deceased, stated that there were 5 wounds on the head of the deceased, 4 of which appeared to have been inflicted a week or more before her death, that the 5th was a fresh wound, about 1.5 inches long and to the bone, and was, in his opinion, sufficient to have produced her death, that there were many other wounds on different parts of her body which were sufficient independent of those on the head to have caused death. The reasons assigned by the prisoner to those who witnessed his inhuman treatment of the deceased were, at one time, that she stole his turnips and sold them to the worthless people in the neighborhood, and that she had attempted to burn his barn, and was disobedient and impudent to her mistress. At another, that she had attempted to burn his stillhouse, and had put something in a pot to poison his family. There was no evidence, except her own confessions, extorted by severe whippings, that the deceased was guilty of any of the crimes imputed to her, nor did it appear that she was disobedient or impertinent to her master or mistress. Presumably such impudence would have been an extenuation to some extent, or else that fact would not have been mentioned. To continue. On the contrary, she seemed, as some of the witnesses testified, to do her best to obey the commands of her master, just as Philander Castile did his best to obey the commands of his master, and that when she failed to do so, it was from absolute inability to comply with orders to which her condition and strength were unequal. The prisoner offered no testimony, that is to say, Mr. Hoover, the slave, quote-unquote, owner. His Honor charged the jury that they must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the prisoner killed the deceased, that he intended to kill her, and that he had no legal provocation at the time for killing her, before they would be justified in finding him guilty of murder, that if they doubted on any of those points, they ought not to find him guilty of murder, which is a sound instruction. This is where things get a little bit weird. He charged the jury further that if the deceased attempted to burn the barn, still house, or kitchen of the defendant, or if she put poison in a pot to poison the family, or stole turnips, or disobeyed the orders of her master, these were all acts of legal provocation. Notice how one of these things is not like the others. Disobeying the orders of her master would have been an extenuating circumstance, just as destroying the property, that is to say, the physical legitimate property of Mr. Hoover, or somehow threatening the physical life of Mr. Hoover or his family. Those things are legitimate provocations toward the exercise of punitive violence up to and including the potential lethal exercise of force, just as disobeying orders would be as well. These were all acts of legal provocation, and if the defendant killed the deceased upon the discovery of any of the aforesaid offenses, once again, the supposed offenses include disobeying orders from somebody who presumed to own Mira, or in so short a time thereafter that the passion of the defendant had not a reasonable time to subside, the slaying would be manslaughter and not murder. His Honor further charged the jury that if they were satisfied beyond a rational doubt that the defendant was the slayer, and that they were further satisfied that he had no legal provocation at the time of the slaying, or so short a time before, that his passion had not a reasonable time to cool and subside, that they were at liberty to presume a deliberate intent to kill, and it would be murder. If she had made him angry through her impudence, and in the fit of passion he killed her, that would have been considered manslaughter and not murder. How does that extenuation differ in a material sense from the familiar police officer's refrain, "I feared for my life, and I was acting in the heat of the moment"? I contend that it differs not at all, because the premises are exactly the same. I will be back shortly.
Force use has to be reasonable and necessary, and who judges that reasonable and necessary? It is to the officer's standard. Does the public understand and are they trained in the dynamics of use of force like you and I are? No. Well, educate them. Teach them. And now you've got people on your side. Establish, articulate, and document.
You have to know your policy. You should know it inside and out.
I have previously referred to something I call the Tom Joad test, which is the following. If you happen to see a police officer or a government official of some sort inflicting violence upon another individual, do you instinctively sympathize with the person on the receiving end of state-licensed violence or with the person who is inflicting it? If the first is true, you are acting in harmony with the American premise of law and society, which is that government has to justify its actions when they result in injury to another human being. You are to that extent a libertarian in your outlook. If the latter is true, if you simply assume that the police officer must be justified in what he is doing, then you are an instinctive authoritarian and to that extent an American in your perspective on how society should function. The New American Magazine, a publication for which I was senior editor for about 12 years, consistently flunks the Tom Joad test with respect to the actions undertaken by state and local police officers and sheriff's departments. They tend to be somewhat more skeptical, but not consistently so, when you're talking about the actions of the FBI or a similar federal enforcement agency. But when a police officer or a sheriff's deputy or a state trooper is involved in an act of violence, whether traumatic or lethal, against a citizen, the New American Magazine assumes that that action is self-ratifying, that we simply cannot subject this type of government behavior to the rational scrutiny that we otherwise employ when we're talking about the actions of any other element of the Leviathan state. They are more consistently critical of local teachers and local teachers' unions than they are of police officers. Teachers and teachers' unions employed by the government mind laundry do immense damage. They very rarely kill somebody without cause, however, and that is something that happens dozens or scores or hundreds or perhaps even thousands of times every year. We don't know because police officers do not give a detailed accounting of the use of lethal force, particularly when they involve matters that are not adjudicated. The Black Lives Matter crowd has used the police shootings of two black men to accuse all white people, all police officers, and especially all white police officers, of systematic racism and targeting black men for murder, begins a typical screed from the July 14th issue of the New American Magazine dealing with the Philando Castile killing. In a previous article, the New American reported on what is known about Alton Sterling's death and the events leading up to it, but what about Philando Castile, who was shot and killed by a police officer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, while, according to his girlfriend, he was just reaching for his wallet? There are some similarities and some differences in these two shootings and in the lives of the black men who were shot, while the Black Lives Matter crowd has focused on only the similarities that serve its purpose. Both men were black, while none of the officers involved was black. They have avoided the similarities that are both most obvious and most important. And herewith begins an attack upon the character of the victim of this exercise of lethal government force. Both men were suspects in crimes involving the threat of lethal force. That isn't true. Alton Sterling was. Philando Castile was not. he supposedly matched in the broadest possible way the general description of somebody suspected in an armed robbery, but he himself was not a suspect. And by describing him as a suspect, the New American Magazine is libeling his memory, and I certainly hope that his estate will take the appropriate legal action in order to receive due correction of that misrepresentation. Both men were armed. Yes, one of them was armed legally. Both men refused to comply with officers' commands. That, as we know, is not true, and it should have been known to be untrue by the New American in the immediate flush of the events. But they could not admit as much, because the dogma of support your local police bewitches their intelligence and makes them incapable of examining the actions of police officers with proper skepticism. Whether Castile was involved in the robbery or not is not known for certain and is not the point anyway, insists the author of this piece, after making that the point in the first paragraphs of the article. The point is that Black Lives Matter claims to the contrary. This situation had nothing to do with race and everything to do with Castile's failure to obey the officer's commands. It is not the place of media, BLM, social media activists, BLM in this case meaning Black Lives Matter, or social justice warriors to determine whether the officers acted appropriately or inappropriately. That is a consistent refrain that we hear from the New American, but only with respect to police officers. We are supposed to hold everybody else accountable, but police officers, those who are to the state as the edge is to the blade, they are beyond scrutiny. They are beyond accountability to mere mundanes from the perspective of the New American Magazine. This is for the investigation to decide. Well, the investigation decided whether or not this was an appropriate use of force. The suburban police officer who fatally shot Philando Castile, the black driver whose last moments this summer were streamed live on Facebook, was charged on Wednesday with second-degree manslaughter and accused of escalating a mundane roadside exchange into a needlessly violent episode, begins a November 16th piece from the New York Times. In outlining the case against Officer Geronimo Yanez, prosecutors described a traffic stop on July 6th that spiraled out of control when Officer Yanez overreacted to the presence of Mr. Castile's lawfully carried gun and shot him, despite pleas that he was not reaching for the weapon. No reasonable officer, knowing, seeing, and hearing what Officer Yanez did at the time, would have used deadly force under these circumstances, the Ramsey County Attorney John J. Choi said. Officer Yanez, who will appear in court on Friday, and once again he was not taken into custody. He would have been taken into custody if he had failed to pay a traffic ticket. Was also charged with two felony counts of intentional discharge of a dangerous weapon. Mr. Choi said Officer Yanez spotted Mr. Castile, a 32-year-old school cafeteria worker, driving along a stretch of road near the state fairgrounds with his girlfriend and her young daughter. Officer Yanez believed Mr. Castile matched the description of a suspect in a nearby armed robbery from a few days earlier, radioing a colleague that Mr. Castile's wide-set nose seemed to match the surveillance video from that case, and that his car also had a broken taillight. But when Officer Yanez pulled Mr. Castile over in the tiny suburb of Falcon Heights, the conversation described by the prosecutors started out as ordinary, with no mention of the robbery and no discussion of the smell of marijuana that Officer Yanez would later recount to investigators, and that is a very standard tactic used by police. He supposedly saw a wide-set nose, evincing the type of vision that perhaps Superman would envy, and then later on he claimed to have smelled marijuana, which is something that they are taught to say in order to justify after the fact a stop that would not pass legal scrutiny. Mr. Choi said Wednesday that Mr. Castile was not a suspect in the armed robbery case. Mr. Castile, who had been pulled over dozens of times before, seemed to know the routine. He kept his seatbelt fastened, greeted Officer Yanez, and handed over his insurance card, according to prosecutor's version of events. Then, before his girlfriend said he reached for the wallet that contained his driver's license and permit to carry a pistol, Mr. Castile said, "Sir, I have to tell you that I do have a firearm on me." Within seconds, Officer Yanez of the St. Anthony Police had shouted, "Don't pull it out," and Mr. Castile and his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, tried to reassure him that he was not grabbing the gun. But Officer Yanez quickly fired 7 rounds, fatally wounding Mr. Castile just 62 seconds after the traffic stop began. An instant later, Mr. Castile moaned and said, "I wasn't reaching for it." His dying words were in protest that he wasn't reaching for his gun, Mr. Choi said. What about the role played by protesters? people who shut down interstates and violate the property rights of others are not protesters, they're a mob. However, there were protesters who exercised their constitutionally protected right to petition the government for redress of grievances, who had an influence on this case. From the perspective of the New American Magazine and the John Birch Society, however, these are part of the same crowd. They do not disambiguate the peaceful, principled citizen activists from people who may be professional protesters or simply opportunistic thugs. As far as they're concerned, nobody has the right to protest when a police officer executes a citizen without legal cause. Mr. Castile's death is among the highest profile cases of the countless police interactions with black men that have roiled the country, and especially Minnesota, in the last 2 years. None of those other cases in Minnesota have led to criminal charges, and activists and Mr. Castile's family greeted Wednesday's announcement as a validation of their efforts and as a possible turning point. As the case against Officer Yanez moves toward trial, Mr. Castile's mother, Valerie, urged any protests to remain peaceful and said that her family was pleased with the decision to bring charges. "We all hope and pray that the right thing is done," she said. "These people are seeking due process. They're not acting to tear down the system. They're demanding that the system make good on its promises of equal protection before the law. And that is something, once again, that badge-worshipping sycophants like the people who run the John Birch Society and the New American Magazine simply cannot countenance. Because as far as they're concerned, the police are superior to the rest of us. They're acting on behalf of the government that presumes to own us. And we act beyond our station when we criticize the actions of our slave overseers." I'll be back in just a minute.
Stop right where you are. You know the score, pal. You're not cops, you're little people.
Alice Ristroff of Seton Hall University's Law School points out that as things stand right now with respect to constitutional law issues, what is called the law of police force has a redistributive function. It redistributes the risk of being subjected to violence from the citizen to the representative of the state. And she also points out, bear in mind, I suppose it's relevant to point out, that Dr. Ristroff is white, not black. She points out, on the basis of her research, that although the law is ostensibly race-neutral, the duty of compliance has in fact been distributed along racial lines and may be contrasted with the privilege of resistance, also race-specific, elsewhere protected in American law. "Blue lights in the rearview mirror are familiar to every American with a driver's license," begins an essay entitled The Constitution of Police Violence, which is scheduled to be published in 2017 by the UCLA Law Review. "Most of us have obeyed the signal and pulled over, unhappy though we may be about it. A bullet from a service revolver is not, in contrast, something that many of us ever expect to receive. Though police killings remain relatively rare events, they are arguably not rare enough, especially for persons of color. Deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of officers have gripped the nation's attention for the past few years. These killings are widely, though not universally, condemned. But the condemnations typically focus on the moment of killing, on the specific choice to use deadly force, and not on the police activity that preceded it. That's something I have emphasized on many occasions. This is a taking. This is a seizure of your person by a police officer. And at the point of the seizure, it is entirely within the discretion of the officer the extent to which he will escalate the encounter, and then after the fact blame you for supposedly triggering his escalation. That narrow focus has contributed to the misperception that the killings are the anomalous, unauthorized acts of rogue officers. Against that view, this article shows that the same legal framework that authorizes and normalizes the ordinary traffic stop also permits and even encourages killings of unarmed suspects. One constitutional conventional word, seizures, encompasses a wide range of police activity, from the brief investigative stop, short of a full arrest, all the way to the killing of a suspect. And one other word, unreasonable, is all that the constitutional text itself offers to distinguish licit seizures from illicit. Across the spectrum of police seizures, from stops to shootings, reasonableness is doctrinally defined almost exclusively in terms of just two criteria, suspicion and non-submission. Suspicion of any legal violation, even a civil offense, is sufficient to justify at least an investigative stop, and greater levels of suspicion justify longer or more intrusive seizures. Once police have made an initial seizure, even if just a brief investigative stop, non-submission by the suspect gives the police authority to use force. Supposedly, I append at the end of that sentence. Indeed, actual non-submission is not even a prerequisite to the use of force. An officer who suspects non-submission, who believes that the person seized may resist with violence or otherwise may pose a danger to the officer or others, becomes empowered to use force against that person, even if the officer is mistaken. Importantly, race is at once central and irrelevant to this suspicion non-submission formula. It is central in that officers' beliefs that a person is suspicious or non-submissive seem at least partly determined by race in many instances. That was certainly true in the case of Philando Castile. But racialized motivations are mostly irrelevant to the formal authority to make a seizure. To make these general doctrinal rules more concrete, think of the now familiar pattern that characterizes many highly publicized recent killings. The encounter begins with a seemingly minor police intervention, a traffic stop, an order by the officer to stop walking in the street, an arrest for a petty offense such as selling loose cigarettes. The suspect is insufficiently cooperative, or perhaps only apparently non-cooperative. The officer asserts greater authority, the seizure quickly escalates, and the officer concludes that he is in danger. He kills the suspect. Later it is discovered that the suspect was unarmed. In many cases, there is public condemnation of the officer and in some cases an effort to indict or prosecute. Even if a prosecutor does pursue charges, the officer is likely to avoid conviction. As this pattern has repeated itself, there has been surprisingly little attention to the constitutional rules that set the boundaries of seizure authority. Some commentators have sought to understand why prosecutors or officers fail and what legal reforms may make prosecution successful, but the proposed reforms take the constitutional framework for granted. Constitutional in this context, I hasten to specify, refers to case law, not the actual text of the Constitution of the United States or any of the constituent states of the Soyuz. Other commentators have looked for alternative methods to reduce violence, such as training officers to de-escalate or to be aware of implicit biases that may distort the decision to use force. I don't have any brief for the implicit biases training. I don't think it's useful. I don't think it's realistic. People have implicit biases. That's something that we simply have to recognize and to a certain extent accommodate as a reality of the human condition. The question isn't whether or not somebody is biased against a person or a group of people. The question is, at what point is somebody entitled to use force? And the only legitimate use of force is purely defensive in nature. These efforts to understand and address police violence have, by and large, identified either individual officers or police departments as the most important decision makers. They have not focused on or faulted the constitutional doctrine, once again we're talking case law, that defines the scope of the officer's authority. In other words, the usual critiques of police shootings operate on the underlying assumption that the officer who chose to shoot made a bad choice against a backdrop of reasonable, if somewhat indeterminate, legal guidelines. Responsibility for the killings is placed with the officers or, in the view of the officer's defenders, with the non-compliant suspects. Once again, they gave cause to their overseer to fear for his life, and because the overseer obviously cannot be put in fear for his life, then the impudent slave got what was coming to him or to her. And not with the constitutional doctrine that structures police authority, nor with the people who have crafted that doctrine, nor with the people, the definite article, capital P, people, on whose behalf the doctrine is crafted. To reduce or redistribute the risks of violence during police encounters, concludes Dr. Ristroff, it is probably necessary to rethink the two broad criteria for reasonable seizures, suspicion and non-submission. What she's talking about here is reconstituting the police as an actual corps of peace officers protecting persons and property, rather than deploying them upon the public as revenue collectors. It is worth asking, for example, whether suspicion of any legal violation merits a forcible police intervention. Instead of prosecuting police officers, we might ask them to do less, to give up on protecting the county from the scourge of broken taillights, for example, and to focus more narrowly on addressing the most serious forms of criminal conduct. That suggestion is not novel. A number of critics have decried the ease with which suspicion thresholds are satisfied and the resulting broad scope of police discretion. But this article adds to prior critiques by showing that the costs of low suspicion thresholds are not merely the intrusions of stop and frisks, but also civilian lives, especially the lives of those civilians most likely to be deemed suspicious. And once again, I interject, there is a racial component, inevitably, to that calculation. More controversial than a call to rethink the constitutional doctrine of suspicion, I suspect, will be this article's recommendation to reevaluate the doctrinal significance of resistance or non-submission. Police officers should be obeyed, the orthodox view holds, and their authority should not be questioned except by after-the-fact litigation that gives courts, not suspects, the final word. Especially in the wake of the murders of several Dallas and Baton Rouge police officers in the summer of 2016, any allowance for resistance may seem unwise. But today's blanket condemnation of resistance toward officers cloaks a more complicated national history, one that celebrates, selectively, individual rights to refuse compliance with oppressive state agents. I would point out at this juncture that the New American Magazine celebrated armed resistance to law enforcement, both federal and local, at Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014. It has referred to the late Lavoie Finicum of blessed memory as somebody who was murdered by the police in spite of the fact that he had been part of an armed protest and he had a gun in his possession and arguably was reaching for it at the time he was shot and killed. Once again, this is selective celebration of the right to resist. That's the same publication that routinely treats any police killing of a black suspect as self-ratifying. When viewed alongside the common law right to resist unlawful arrest, once widely recognized in the United States, and alongside the recently resurgent Second Amendment right to bear arms, the Fourth Amendment's treatment of resistance as a license for officers to use force seems less self-evident and perhaps less defensible. At the very least, we should identify and defend the distributive implications of our rules of resistance. We should be honest about who has the privilege to resist and who bears the burden of compliance or the burdens of others' fears of non-compliance. This is a very useful place to begin a badly overdue discussion, but the obvious solution here is to recognize that we should not countenance any longer the state's claimed monopoly on security. Until we actually reprivatize the function of protecting persons and property, we're always going to have problems of this kind. Because at some level, we're all going to be seen as the property of the state, and the police are going to be treated as our slave overseers. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and also at thelibertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.